US military base in Diego Garcia. Now, do you think this secretive airbase is the main reason that Britain continues to illegally occupy the Chagos Island?
Oh, absolutely. That is the main question. The U.S. base was the reason, the only reason, for the deportation of the Chagosians. The U.S. military base on Diego Garcia is the reason for the apartheid laws to keep the Chagosians out of the entire Chagos archipelago. The U.S., not Great Britain, is the real master of the Chagos Islands. And for reasons that are not really clear, the U.S. wants all of the Chagos atolls clear of people. Even though there's only a single military base at Diego Garcia, they want a massive section of the Indian Ocean clear of all population. It is true that there's a massive base at Diego Garcia, which houses Naval, Air Force, and U.S. Space Force assets now, but still, they have tried to clear a actual immense section of the Indian Ocean from all scrutiny.
The U.S. has made every effort to draw attention to alleged disregard for international law by its adversaries, while conveniently ignoring that law's application to the U.S. presence on Diego Garcia. Now, what's your take, Mr. Levy?
It must be remembered that the United States is the main opponent of international law in the world. The United States does not recognize the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice. The United States has ignored rulings against it on Nicaragua, and former President Trump even put sanctions on the International Criminal Court and its prosecutors. The Biden administration has not removed those sanctions. If the U.S. ever wants to regain respect in international relations, it must honor its international obligations and follow international law. President Biden campaigned for president, claiming he was the greatest anti-apartheid fighter in the history of the United States Congress. Yet, here we are, with the U.S. supporting English racism in the Chagos Islands. Again and again, the hypocrisy continues.
Now, from our conversation today, it's quite clear that a lot needs to be done to eject Britain from its last colony in Africa. Here at Africa Today, we shall keep you posted on the struggle for the liberation of Chagos. Stay tuned, and we'll be back soon with analysis on the upsurge of Boko Haram attacks in northern Nigeria.
Surge in Boko Haram attacks.
The Boko Haram terrorist group has increased its deadly attacks and kidnappings in Nigeria. There is concern that this terrorist group is changing tactics and carrying out more kidnappings for ransom. In February, Boko Haram terrorists kidnapped more than 300 schoolgirls, marking the third mass abduction since December.
The general security situation is taking a turn for the worse. Amit reports that in the first 6 weeks of 2021, at least 1,525 Nigerians were killed across the country. Women and children are bearing the brunt of insecurity in Nigeria. A woman here mourns the killing of her brother.
So For more analysis on the security situation in Nigeria, especially the spike in Boko Haram attacks, we have contacted Dr. Mojuba Olu Okome, a professor of political science at Brooklyn College of City University of New York. Thanks a lot for your time, madam.
My pleasure.
Dr. Okome, can we say that the recent increase in attacks by Boko Haram is a pointer that this Takfiri terrorist group is still strong despite claims by the government that it's technically defeated?
Yes, unfortunately, Boko Haram is still strong because it's able to swoop down at will, abduct people. So the scope of its activities is spreading. It was in the northeast, and now we are having more action in the northwest.
Thanks, Dr. Okome. Now, you have said there that Boko Haram attacks are spreading far and wide. Now, why has the Nigerian government failed to defeat this terrorist group despite having one of the strongest armies in Africa?
I think that Nigerian government has to really do a serious assessment about its strategies and its what it's done so far to identify why it has been impossible to end this reign of terror by Boko Haram, despite the fact that actually our president had said that technically Boko Haram was defeated. But technicalities are not what we need. We need for Nigerian school children to be safe and secure. We need Nigerian citizens to feel the security that comes from Boko Haram actually being defeated in reality. That hasn't happened, and it is unacceptable.
Indeed, it's unacceptable that innocent Nigerians have suffered for over 10 years as Boko Haram continues to grow stronger. But who's funding or sustaining the activities of Boko Haram? Who are the foreign backers, if any, of Boko Haram terrorists?
One thing that Boko Haram has said clearly is that it owes allegiance to ISIS, you know. And, you know, so there are allegations that are thrown around about foreign backers of all sorts, about the porous nature of Nigeria's borders, about the arms and ammunition, very dangerous ones, that have flooded the market after Gaddafi's fall, being cheaply available to groups like Boko Haram, whoever the backers are.
Dr. Okome there mentioned that the ISIS terrorist group is the international affiliate of the Boko Haram. Now, lest we forget, the extremist Wahhabi ideology that is propagated and promoted by Saudi Arabia is the reason for the existence of ISIS or Daesh terrorist group, and indeed other terrorist groups such as Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram that are spreading mayhem and killing innocent people in Africa. Now, how has the spread of Wahhabism contributed to the increase in power of Takfiri terrorist groups such as Boko Haram?
Oh, tremendously. You know, because there are these values that are held by groups that espouse Wahhabism. They are very convinced that their version of Islam is the only legitimate one. They are wedded to a very draconian interpretation. They're very intolerant. Frankly, you know, they are not accepted by many Muslims as legitimate in their take about what to do in society as Muslims, what to do as Muslims who are obedient to the will of Allah, and how to relate to fellow Muslims and other non-Muslim religious communities and even secular communities.
The Boko Haram insurgency has displaced over 2.5 million people in the Lake Chad Basin. Civilians in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger continue to be affected by grave violations of human rights, widespread sexual and gender-based violence, forced recruitment, and suicide bombings. A Nigerian living in a refugee camp does not see the situation improving soon.
Now I'm in God's hands. If peace is restored one day and I'm told I can go back home, I'll go back to my village immediately. But time goes by and the situation isn't changing, so there's no way I can go home.
How are the Boko Haram attacks impacting on the daily lives of Nigerians?
Wahhabism has strengthened the capacity of groups like Boko Haram to cause devastation and, you know, inflict a lot of brutal pain on people. You know, so in Nigeria, over 2 million people are internally displaced as a result of Boko Haram's rampaging. First of all, at that time, it was over 2 million is when it was active only in the northeast. Now it has extended to the northwest, so the number of internally displaced people is going to rise.
The unrest has become a political problem for President Muhammadu Buhari, who has faced mounting criticism in recent months over high-profile attacks by Boko Haram terrorists and bandits. During his New Year's speech, Buhari admitted that Boko Haram attacks have thwarted his government efforts to eradicate poverty.
In parts of the country where chronic poverty, social exclusion, and disillusionment among sections of the youth were already a problem, the circles of violence that have been unleashed by mindless groups like Boko Haram and others have thwarted the efforts of government to undertake the social policy and associated investments that could make a huge difference in the quality of life of our citizens.
Now, Dr. Akome, as we wind up, can you tell us what will it take to defeat Boko Haram terrorists?
Efforts need to be made to build peace based on psychological, social, economic, and military strategies. Only the military strategy won't work, especially because these are not people who are like an orthodox formal army, you know. They're in communities among people who are afraid of them, who will not probably speak out against them because they are afraid of reprisal. So the normal military strategies are not sufficient to fight this. And, you know, within Islam too, the Muslim leaders need to really do a lot of work to convince people who have bought into this ideology that there are ways of being obedient to Allah, of being a Muslim, that totally is diametrically opposed to the Boko Haram perspective.
Now, Dr. Okome there says that a military strategy is not enough to defeat Boko Haram, and that there are cultural, economic, and religious dimensions to the Northern Nigeria conflict. Well, that's it for this edition of Africa Today. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, I'd like to thank you all. Take care and goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the 8th session of the Assembly.
یک مثال دیگری که از اینها به نظر من مهمتره این آیه شریفه ما ارسلنا من رسول الله لیطاع باذن الله.
Another example, which in my opinion is more important than the others, is this holy ayah. We sent not an apostle, but to be obeyed in accordance with the will of Allah. Noble Quran, chapter 4, verse 64. How many of the prophets fought in Allah's way, and with them fought large groups of godly men? The Noble Quran, chapter 3, verse 146. Imam Khomeini brought this concept to the arena of action. He utilized the ayah, I admonish you on one point, that you rise before Allah, it may be in pairs or it might be singly. The Noble Quran, chapter 34, verse 46, in that direction. He utilized the ayah, I admonish you on one point, that you rise before Allah, it may be in pairs or it may be singly, in that direction. It may be in pairs or it may be singly does not mean saying daily prayers. Rather, it means establishing a government and an Islamic system. Imam Khomeini utilized this concept and launched a movement with it in the year 1341 in the Iranian calendar.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith. To be stronger
بعد در طول زمان متفکرین، علاقمندان، ارادتمندان، شاگردان امام و در رأس همه خود امام.
Later on, thinkers, enthusiasts, imam supporters and pupils and at the top of them, imam himself, promoted this thought in the course of time until it led to the establishment and victory of the revolution and the government based on the revolution. Notice that Quranic and Islamic concepts and the ideological concepts of Islam can exert such an influence in life once they're implemented in practice. So, this is an example of the miraculous effects of such a procedure and endeavor. How we should carry out this task is another issue. Then, the Islamic government was established.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
To Allah. the debate.
The United States and China clashed during the first high-level, in-person meeting of the Biden administration held in Anchorage, Alaska. The meeting kicked off with senior American diplomats accusing China of threatening world stability and Chinese officials saying the U.S. is a human rights hypocrite because of its mistreatment of its African-American citizens. Ties between Washington and Beijing particularly soured under former U.S. President Donald Trump, who clashed with China on trade, technology, regional security, among other issues. President Joe Biden's administration has generally backed the tougher approach initiated by Trump. Biden has described China as Washington's most serious competitor, saying the U.S. would continue to confront what he has called China's attack on human rights, intellectual property, and global governance. Beijing has rejected those charges and repeatedly said that the U.S. must stop interfering in its internal affairs.
In particular, this first high-level meeting between the U.S. and China under Joe Biden's presidency gets off to a frosty start, putting the deeply strained relations between the two countries on public display. The opening session of a two-day meeting in Alaska saw top American and Chinese officials hurling accusations at each other in front of the world media. During the meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken accused China of threatening the global stability, conducting cyber attacks against the U.S., and practicing economic coercion. He also lashed out at Beijing for what he called committing human rights violations, including in Hong Kong. Senior Chinese diplomat Yang Jiechi reacted by calling the U.S. allegations hypocritical. He noted that Washington's own human rights records are at a low point, especially with regard to its treatment of African Americans who are being, quote, slaughtered there. Yang also accused Washington of using its military might and financial power to suppress other countries. The senior Chinese official said Washington, with its unfounded allegations, is trying to obstruct normal trade exchanges and inciting some countries to attack China. The two top economies have been at loggerheads for years over a host of issues, including trade, cybersecurity, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. The U.S. has also been on the forefront over China's maritime dispute with some of its neighbors over the South China Sea, siding with Beijing's rivals and routinely dispatching warships and warplanes to the region. Experts believe the U.S. is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power.
The United States is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power. Now, China has an economy that's roughly half the size of that of the United States, but China has been making gains on the United States, as we know, in recent years.
The Sino-American relations sank to their lowest level under former President Donald Trump, who initiated a trade war with China using tariffs as a pressure tool. The Biden administration has taken a somber approach as it views the Sino-American relations as the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century. However, it has so far refrained from rolling back Trump's policies to mend bilateral relations. It appears Biden is following in Trump's footsteps not only with regard to China, but other global issues. 2 months after his inauguration, Biden has also failed to live up to his campaign promise of returning to the UN-endorsed 2015 Iran nuclear deal that was signed during his vice presidency but abandoned by Trump in 2018. Iran says Biden is no different from his predecessor when it comes to honoring the accord. Tensions have also escalated between Moscow and Washington in recent days, with Russia warning that bilateral ties are, quote, on the brink of collapse. That after the U.S. president called his Russian counterpart a killer and warned that Vladimir Putin will pay the price for what he claimed meddling in the U.S. presidential election.
Well, joining us on tonight's debate, we have independent political analyst Gilbert Doctorow joining us from Brussels. Also, we have Senior Research Fellow at Global Policy Institute, Mr. George Samueli, joining us from Budapest. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Doctorow in Brussels. The meeting was far from a promising start. How do you think the Biden administration will approach dealing with China going forward from here?
I think the overarching element of U.S. policy towards China that has now been confirmed by the behavior of the American delegation in Anchorage is containment. The overarching principles of U.S. foreign policy under Biden, as relates to both China and Russia, is of the Cold War vintage. It is ideologically driven. It's based on an assumption that there is a free world and a world of countries that are ruled by autocrats, and that these are in constant confrontation, and that the United States is going to rally its allies under the umbrella of this free world. In this sense, the actions that the Biden administration took, both the president himself in his description of Vladimir Putin as a killer, and of the Blinken delegation to Anchorage by its public denunciation of China, they were in both cases trying to set the policy line for the allies to follow. And in both instances, I believe they made a terrible blunder, because Europe in particular is not the least bit keen to follow the United States in a confrontation that includes a trade and a power politics confrontation with China. As your as one of the quotations made at the start of this program, China has one half of the economic scale of the United States. That is extremely misleading. It depends how you calculate. Depends very much on the exchange rate, and by purchasing power equivalency, many specialists would say that in 1 or 2 years, China will be bypassing the United States. And by normal exchange rate calculations, there's the wide expectation that China will have a greater economy than the United States by the end of this decade. In these circumstances, the European allies are not in the least interested in following the dictates of Blinken and Biden and spurning the Chinese or baiting the Chinese as Blinken was doing in Anchorage.
George Samueli, it didn't look like much of a reset in relations. China also had some strong pushback. What do you think is Beijing's view on this relationship, especially after the Alaska meeting?
Well, I think China is extremely annoyed with the Biden administration's policy. Let's keep in mind what happened yesterday. What happened yesterday was an absolutely diplomatic calamity for the United States, because within hours of each other, both Moscow and Beijing humiliated the United States. And say what you will about the Donald Trump years and his aggressive, bombastic style of policymaking, such a thing never happened during the Trump years. Now, why the Chinese have responded in this particular way is that the Biden people have come to China not with putting forward a coherent agenda, which is what you're supposed to do whenever you have any kind of a diplomatic meeting, but with a lot of talk about values and the suggestion that somehow China is failing up to the U.S. desired values, that China is violating what the U.S. calls the rules-based order. Now, the Chinese really don't like that sort of talk, because they feel that the rules-based order is largely a fraud, whereby the United States and its allies make up the rules and everybody else has to follow orders. So they don't like that, and they particularly don't like when the United States starts raising human rights issues. The moment they do so, the Chinese invariably point to the human rights shortcomings of the United States. They point to obviously Black Lives Matter, but in a longer historic sequence, there's the general problem America has faced for many years with its African American citizens. But what the Biden people are doing is, instead of talking about palpable, real national interests, which is what Trump was doing, interests that involve trade, interests that involved currency manipulation and interests that involved the issue of the virus. How did it come about? When did China know about it? What did China do to contain it? What did China do to alert the world to the danger of the virus? Instead of addressing these issues, the Biden people are talking about issues that are entirely internal Chinese matters. Hong Kong, Taiwan, the Uyghurs, Xinjiang, these are all, and Tibet indeed, these are all issues that the Chinese regard as fall within their jurisdiction, and it's nobody's business but their own. And so when the Biden people talk about these things, it only serves to infuriate the Chinese. It is an absolutely calamitous piece of diplomacy on the part of the United States.
Mr. Del Toro, on that issue, the Chinese side have told the U.S. delegation that many people within the United States actually have little confidence in the democracy of Washington, and they have various views regarding the government of the United States. Does the U.S. have the moral authority to discuss democracy and human rights?
Well, it doesn't. And it's still, I would characterize these Chinese remarks as being very traditional in a Cold War discussion. They used to call this whataboutism. It was attacks on the Soviet Union for its human rights abuses, and Izvestia or Pravda the next day would have a litany of American abuses in the human rights category. And this brings us to what we are witnessing. As I said a few moments ago, this is a Cold War dialogue which is set up and imposed on China, on Russia, by the United States. Neither of these countries is guided by ideological considerations. They're very pragmatic, and they're very open to the world. It is the United States that has turned inwards on its own past. After Mr. Biden made his remarks about Putin the killer, the Russians, the Russian experts and Russian television commentators raised the question whether Mr. Biden is senile. And they debated this, discussed this from every angle. The consensus seemed to be that no, he is not senile, that he is fully conscious of the environment around him, and that he has a very good memory. However, in one sense, he is senile. He is trapped in time. His mindset is from 30 years ago, and he's brought that with him to the White House. The world has changed a lot since 1989. Unfortunately, Mr. Biden has not.
Mr. Samueli, what is China's main priority in its relations with Washington? What is it really looking for?
Well, I think that it's very happy to have a proper great power competition, whatever you call it, with the United States. If the United States has specific issues that it wants to address, such as trade, currency, etc., that China is happy to deal with those issues. What China won't tolerate is talk from the United States about values and obvious interference in its internal affairs. And they regard that what the United States has been doing in Hong Kong, what the United States has been doing in Xinjiang, is clearly interference in its internal affairs. And China guards its national sovereignty jealously. Now, there is a real problem here, and if we talk about geopolitics, which is that China is the power on the rise. It's risen very, very rapidly in just a matter of a few decades. It's the country that it was when Richard Nixon visited it in 1972 is just not a shadow of the great power it's become now. And the United States sees this, the United States resents this, and the United States is not going to allow it to be eclipsed easily. This is something that we know from history. Great powers do not let themselves be eclipsed by other great powers without putting up a fight, and the Chinese know this. And so the question now is, how can the United States accommodate itself to a multipolar world with Russia as a great power, China as an economic power that is at least the equal, if not the superior, of the United States. How can it accommodate itself to this multipolar world when the United States has really enjoyed several decades of ruling over a unipolar world? We hope that it will accommodate itself peacefully, but there's a real danger that peace is not on the cards.
Mr. Del Toro, the same question, but from a different vantage point. What does the U.S. really want from the China talks?
Well, in the United States, in the world at large, foreign policy is often a projection of domestic policy. And nowhere is this more true than of the United States. Everything that we've seen in the last few days bears this out. Mr. Biden, in his remarks about Putin, was addressing his own Democratic Party supporters. In the question of dealing with China and how it was handled in Anchorage, the Biden administration was looking to have a lockdown, to have a tight control over both political parties, since both Democrats and Republicans are rather close on this single issue in foreign policy. So what we saw in Anchorage was not so much, particularly in the open session, was not so much an interaction with the Chinese as an interaction with the American home viewers and home journalists. It was an attempt to impose the Biden administration views on domestic politics in the United States. It was not an outreach to China. Now, what may have happened behind closed doors, that's another matter. But I wouldn't look for a great deal. The United States is looking to maintain its global hegemony and to contain the powers that are rising. China is the most obvious rising power and rivals the United States in every economic dimension and also in technology. Russia is not obvious as a rising power, but it is, in fact. There is no comparison between Russia today and the Russia of the pre-1989 Soviet period. It is a leaner and a much tougher country, tougher in international policy and in power projection. It is a military force that rivals NATO, which the United States reluctantly faces. So the United States, in the last several days, has been facing up to its two main rivals, and has done so in a deplorable way, and I think is creating for itself great problems because Biden continues to do what the Trump administration has done, which is to drive its two rivals together.
Mr. Samueli, what happens if China takes a no-compromise approach? Many are already calling it the start of a new Cold War-type era.
Well, I think that's a very likely scenario. And now, the United States is trying to create a Asian version of NATO, but there are no takers in Asia because India, South Korea, Japan, Australia, they have no interest whatsoever in getting into a confrontation with China, given the size and the scale of the Chinese military, and they don't really see any need for it. The issues that the United States is raising, the security issues about a variety of sort of uninhabited islands in the South China Sea, they're of no real concern to these Asian powers. Similarly, the border dispute between India and China. Well, South Korea and Japan couldn't care less about this border dispute. So the attempt to create an Asian NATO to contain China will not succeed. But there could be areas in which there would be conflict. I mean, China is building up through its Belt and Road Initiative a variety of alliances throughout Africa and Asia. And the United States does not like it. And so that's an area in which the United States and China could well come into confrontation, particularly over an issue like Iran. I mean, Iran is a thorn in the United States' side, and China has been one of Iran's key allies. So that's an area where the United States and China could come into direct confrontation.
And one last question for Mr. Dokhtar before we close out the program. It's been quite a week in the Biden State Department, first calling Russia's Vladimir Putin a killer, then the exchanges between the U.S. and China. What happened to that less confrontational approach that so many were expecting from the Biden White House, and can this position be held in the long run?
It means, what do you mean by the long run? This position can be held for a good long time, and I think given the stubbornness of the American Congress and its general support for U.S. hegemony as the overriding feature of U.S. foreign policy, I think that Biden's measures will not be challenged seriously. And so the U.S. State Department may very well continue for the next 4 years what we've seen in the last week. The containment issue with China is very different from containment in the Soviet Union because of the technology and because of the scale of the country. The Soviet Union was always a fraction of the United States economy. China is coming up, nudging towards the same scale. And technologically, it is quite quickly becoming a peer of the United States. So containment is likely to fail miserably within this decade, but it will not be changed on the U.S. side next 4 years.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Let me thank my guests, Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent political analyst joining us from Brussels. Also thanks to a senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, joining us from Budapest. And also a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's debate. It's good night for now, and see you next time, everybody.
Nowruz is the message of peace and friendship by the Iranians for the whole world. Happy Nowruz!
In Nowruz, stay with IRIB English Radio to get familiar with Iranian traditions. Happy New Iranian Calendar Year. Happy Nowruz. In the limelight.
A self-powered robot inspired by a fish can survive the extreme pressures at the bottom of the ocean's deepest trench thanks to its soft body and distributed electronic system, and might enable exploration of the uncharted ocean. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Cecilia Laschi-Ryder. This article is published under the heading Soft Robot Reaches the Deepest Part of the Ocean. Stay tuned for more. Riding in nature, Lee et al. Report a robot made from soft materials that can brave the unexplored depths of the sea. Remarkably, the authors demonstrate that the robot can operate in the Mariana Trench, the deepest part of the ocean. Conventional underwater vehicles require watertight enclosures made of metallic materials to withstand the high pressures of the deep ocean. The thickness and dimensions of these enclosures have to be increased to cope with greater depth. But in Lee and colleagues' robot, the delicate electronic components are embedded and distributed in soft silicon, a design that removes the need for pressure-resistant cases. Largely inspired by living organisms, the field of soft robotics involves making robots from reliable materials. Polymers such as silicon are often used, as well as highly deformable structures such as braids and textiles. Soft robots are intrinsically safer than their conventional rigid counterparts in interactions with humans, and their pliability can boost many capabilities such as their dexterity when manipulating objectives, and their ability to squeeze into tight spaces or to travel across uneven surfaces. Marine species such as squid and octopus were one of the original inspirations for soft robotics research. But soft robotics in turn offers a new approach for tackling marine applications of robots. Lee and colleagues' work is a powerful demonstration of this. The author's robot is designed to have a fish-like body shape and two flapping side fins. The authors used a well-established mechanism to drive flapping. The fins are attached to muscles on the robot's body. These are made of a soft material that converts electrical energy into mechanical work. When an electric current from the robot's battery is applied to the muscles, they contract. Tiny solid structures mechanically connect the contracting muscles to the fins, making them flap. Challenges faced by Lee and co-workers was finding a way to protect the robot's electronic components from high pressures. Taking inspiration from the bones in the skull of the Haddle snailfish, the authors spaced the electronic components apart rather than packing them together as is typically done in electronic devices. Laboratory tests and simulations demonstrated that this arrangement reduces the stress at the interfaces between components under pressure. The distributed electronics were then embedded in silicon for incorporation into the robot. This approach is more practical and cheaper than other methods for protecting electronics in deep sea devices. Lee et al. First tested the swimming ability of the robot in the lab, in a pressurized water chamber. The robot was connected to a pole, which it swam around in a circle. The machine was then tested in a lake at a depth of 70 meters, where it swam freely at a speed of 3.16 centimeters per second. And then in South China Sea at a depth of about 3,200 meters. It reached a speed of 5.19 centimeters, equivalent to 45/10th body length per second, which is in line with the capabilities of other soft robots. Finally, the flapping movement and pressure resistance of the robot were tested in the Mariana Trench, where it was connected to a conventional underwater robot for support, which also took images of the test. Several previous attempts have been made to develop soft robots for applications underwater, a realm in which it is challenging for robots to interact delicately with objects because robotic sensors don't work well in this environment. Soft robotic grippers offer substantial advantages over rigid grasping devices when collecting and handling delicate sea organisms for study by marine biologists. And bio-inspired soft robotic fishes can swim among other animals without distressing them, thereby allowing close-up study. Lee and co-workers' research now pushes the boundaries of what can be achieved. The replacement of rigid protective enclosures for electronic components
by distributed electronics embedded in a soft material paves the way for a new generation of deep sea explorers. There is, however, more work to do before the ocean can be populated with robots of this type of design. Lee and co-workers' machine is slower than previously reported underwater robots and cannot withstand sizable disturbances. It could easily be swept away by underwater currents. Its locomotor capabilities will also need to be optimized for practical applications. However, Lee and colleagues' approach lays the foundations for future generations of resilient and reliable deep-sea explorers. In the long term, one can predict avenues of research being opened up for marine biology, in which soft robots safely navigate coral reefs or underwater caves to collect delicate specimens without damaging them. Swarms of underwater soft robots with the ability to crawl on the seabed, anchor themselves on to specific structures, or swim over particular areas could contribute to the development of technologies for various other applications. These might include monitoring the ocean, cleaning up, and preventing sea pollution, or preventing marine biodiversity. More fundamentally, they